My name's Peter, and I'm on CFRU, and
you can be too.
Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is
Scotty Hertz, trying not to blow a gasket, but I think I'll be okay. Remain calm, people. The show is about to begin.
Yeah, just, I mean, it's chilly outside, but we'll try to keep it chill inside.
Chill-o-rama, yes.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. And you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel. Or you can subscribe through iTunes. Today, we will look at another energy project that members of the First Nations community are rallying against. This one, however, is in Canada. It is the dam project at Muskrat Falls, which has taken heat from protesters about the potential for poisoning in communities downriver, who just so happen to be Inuit. But why is it still so hard to consult First Nations peoples on these projects in the first place? And then, in late-breaking news today, it looks like CETA is a done deal. Like many of these situations, though, the Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement was not without controversy, with peak disruption happening last weekend. We'll talk about CETA, why the last-minute negotiations came down to the wire, and the region in Belgium that's the cause of all the fuss. And then, finally, I'm choking on his name.
Better than Ezra Levant.
Ezra Levant is mad at the UN, and not in the usual way. They refused his press credentials for the upcoming COP22 conference in Morocco, and Ezra was so mad he even turned to Justin Trudeau for help. In all seriousness, though, no matter what you think of Levant, do we really want government bodies deciding who is and is not a journalist? Yeah, so first topic is electoral reform. A lot of people want it, and it seemed like Justin Trudeau was desperate to give it to the people, but maybe not so much now. He did an interview with Le Devoir where he said people wanted reform because they were sick of the old government, and they were willing to take electoral reform as a acceptable substitute, if I guess because the slim majority Stephen Harper had seemed so daunting that it could never be defeated. Seems like a weird statement. Some people read it as a flip-flop. And, it could be read as a flip-flop, I think. But I think the more pressing issue is the Special Commons Committee, who's supposed to be coming back with a recommendation on electoral reform soon. Are they going to be able to reach consensus? Because there is one party that is very much holding out for a referendum, and that seems to be the caveat to accepting electoral reform. It's like we have to all go and vote on it.
Yeah, the Electoral Reform Committee, actually called the House Special Committee on Electoral Reform, it consists mostly of opposition members, seven, and I'm not sure what the proportions are. The chair doesn't have a vote, but it's four Liberals and seven opposition members. And it sounds like the Conservatives are holding out for a referendum, which is kind of the default. The problem, there's a couple of problems with the referendum. And one of them isn't the administering of it, but it's that, you know, you have a referendum. It's 50% plus one, which is the kind of thing that needs to be addressed. Not as much 50% plus one in terms of a simple majority. But one of the issues is that we keep getting governments, Liberal or Conservative, when not in a minority situation, are obtaining power with 38-39% of the vote. Mm-hmm. You're saying that, you know, the Liberals, it was pretty resounding last year in terms of how many seats that they won, but they still only became the government with 39% of the vote. And this is problematic. Trudeau says that he's deeply committed to electoral reform, but that's kind of vague. We don't really know what that means. He can be deeply committed to lots of things, but he's probably better off to wait for the committee to come back with their report. I thought it was a bit flippant for him to say, well, you know, they didn't like the government, so that's why they were holding out for me, smile, teeth shine, whatever, cue the lights. That's like shades of the old Trudeau, I think, in terms of it's a bit much to – there are lots of people, lots of parties. And I wouldn't say it's surprisingly the Conservatives, and I've spoken about this before, how when the Conservatives had two seats way back when it was Jean Charest and she just passed away recently. We were talking about her. Name escapes me. But anyway, they had two seats and 3 million votes, and they were like, this isn't right. And there's truth to that. It doesn't matter what the party is. You know, the percentage needs to be higher. And, you know, maybe that's one of the things that they could improve. Rather than doing a whole hog electoral reform and changing the system, they could do something like, okay, let's shift the majority. Let's say you can't be the government until you have – let's run it until we have – you have 50%. Then we know for sure you need to be the government. Or other things like making voting mandatory. I don't think they need to – that wouldn't be a big revamp of the electoral system. It would in a way, but I think you could pass a law saying, okay, you have to vote. If you're of age, you have to vote. That's the law. Then you would have a much more clearer idea as to who really should be the government, which might be surprising and you know, well above this 38, 39. I think the Conservatives at one point, Harper was 36. It was like the lowest ever.
Yeah.
So, and that was around the time when we were going back and forth from minorities, or at least stuck in a minority scenario. So, yeah, Trudeau, I don't know, a bit of the same old song there. We're like, well, they didn't like them, so I don't know.
It's funny you should mention the old Trudeau, because I was thinking about that today.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it reads like something before he became prime minister he would say, and people go, oh, it was a gaffe. It was a gaffe.
Yeah.
But a liberal era, well, this. And now, because he's prime minister now, we take it a bit more seriously when he gaffes like this. Which is understandable, but still, I mean, it does seem like a stupid thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I kind of go back and forth on. I mean, I'm one of those people where I have no doubt there needs to be a change, but I don't know what form or shape a change would take, which is why I kind of like the debate around it and like to hear the arguments around it. Despite all my research, I've still yet to hear kind of a provocative argument about PR, proportional representation, in terms of how it could be enacted in a way that is where you're not going to have a situation where you have an MP for, let's say, Guelph and an MP for like Wellington County. And if your MP for Guelph is liberal and your MP for Wellington County is conservative, how you don't create actually more partisanship, because people are always going to go to the MP that is more their cup of tea. That hasn't been explained to me in a thorough way, or like if we're going to have lists of people
like a slate.
How that's going to work. Like, how are these people chosen? I've always thought the ideal solution would be to make the Senate a proportional body.
Mm-hmm. You mean, or not necessarily?
Well, if you're going to have a slate of people, to even out, representation, you're already appointing people to the Senate anyway, so you're not really creating any sort of constitutional challenges, because it's all appointment. The thing doesn't tell you how you have to appoint it. But it's a nice segue to what happened today, which they appointed 9 new senators today, all of whom are independent and from like various disciplines. There's an art history professor. There's a civil human rights lawyer.
It looked like they did their homework there, and good job by the sounds of it. We don't know yet, but I looked through the list of qualifications. And I was like, yeah, these are probably the people you want in the Senate. And it didn't actually mention, we're at the point now where we don't have parties in the Senate, presumably, supposedly. And this is the new era. But yeah, I looked at that list and I was like, this is somewhat impressive, actually. It isn't just, hey, it seemed much less partisan than it has in the past, I don't know, since Confederation.
Yeah, I mean, right? that's the point, is like, these are like Senate appointees who aren't, partisan hacks, who aren't, you're trying to play regionalism against each other, or you're trying to appoint celebrities or people who've raised a ton of money for the party, or people who could raise a ton of money for the party. Duffy, it's a new approach, and I'm glad to see that this is sort of where the Liberals have followed through. However, having said that, you know, my dream would have been to, you know, make the Senate a proportional bond. And that also gets rid of the job for life caveat as well, because if you're in a situation where one election you have 36 liberal senators and the next election you have 33 liberal senators, well, three of them have got to go. So that was like killing two birds with one stone, so to speak. But like I said, I'm still stuck on this, and I don't think Trudeau was helping anybody. You know, I wish he had just said, you know what, I'm still dedicated to it. We'll see what the Commons Committee comes back with. And yeah, you know, some people might have come back like, oh, he's mealy mouth and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I think Nathan Cullen, I'm not sure if he's on the committee or not, but he said, well, I'm hopeful, but I'm not naive, which is just like, oh. Mm-hmm. So it's like we already have sort of people puncturing holes in the expectations in terms of what's going to come back with. And it doesn't help that the conservatives are standing by going, well, we're not going to do anything unless we get a referendum. I'm not sure who that was an impression of. But
I don't know. It was, felt like it was about 1930, but that's okay because some of them are stuck in
1930. Come on, kid.
Some of them are stuck in 1930, I think, or more.
You
like,
get a paper for the penny, and then we get an evening edition.
Like 1925. You don't need to vote, sis. Yeah. Yeah.
You hear that? Women want to vote now? Holy moly.
Incredible what they're getting away with.
That's the bee's knees.
Oh, my goodness. We could do a whole show in 1920 radio voices. Love this new medium called radio. But back to basics.
Back to basics.
I completely lost track of what it was. Oh, yeah. Well, part of the reason why they're on top of him about this is because he was adamant, and it was a famous statement in the election. He said, this will be the last first-past-the-post election ever.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, you're campaigning on that. You're saying, this is it.
That's new taxes territory.
Yes. Read my lips. And it was mentioned, too, about, again, let's go back to Trudeau Sr., where he said, oh, no. There's going to be no wage and price controls. We're not going to have that. Gets elected. What does he do?
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a pattern here, folks. And I'm not saying that just because that's his father, but it seems that the Liberals will campaign hard like that, where they'll say this, and this. And I guess everybody who's campaigning does it. But Liberals in particular, it seems to stand out because they're so believable and so charming. And then when they get elected, we get this whole, well, you know, actually, we can't really do that. There's been a few things along the way so far where they're pretty adamant about. I think another one is in the area of Indigenous rights. We're like, oh, yes, you're going to get all this thing, you know. And they are doing some things. They're doing more than the Conservatives did in terms of putting money towards, I think, towards improving the water supplies, among other things, right on top of that. So it's not as if they're completely not doing anything at all, but some of the promises, let's say. And I guess we'll talk a bit about that when we get to Muskrat Falls and some of the other things. But yeah, so it's like all that glitters is not Trudeau. I think, where did that come from? I don't know. Nah. I don't know. I think I might have had a bit too much sugar today or something. I don't know. Maybe it's the barometric pressure. I don't know. But yeah, it's... the consensus, I think, among people is that, you know, we want some change, but maybe, you know, it's a very Canadian thing to not want a radical change. Because remember the referendum on mixed member proportional? Oh, it was clobbered in Ontario.
Yeah.
It was like 75%. Yeah, it was huge in terms of like, no, we don't want to change the system. We're okay with first past the post. But like I said off the top,
well, there were a lot of problems with that, for sure. All, that it was like kind of slapped together last minute.
Yeah, and it was, yeah. I had the feeling it was rushed then. And this is the problem with the referendums. You can't really mess around like that. You really have to have done your homework and be on whatever side. Not unlike the 95 referendum where it was, you know, squeaker in terms of Quebec not having the sovereignty association or whatever the heck.
Well, you know, remember too that they've done the legwork too. Yeah, they've set up this Commons Committee, but there's been all these town halls across the country about it, and town halls that have brought a lot of people out. Now, if the intention was to like bury it, they would just have the Commons Committee. They'd get the report and like, yeah, we'll take a look at it, and then like it lands on the pile.
Stacking on top of the other reports.
But they have gone to enormous trouble to try and drum up support for this by going out there with the town hall, sending out Miriam Youssef, Lloyd Longfield here in town, enormously important issue here in Guelph. Lloyd Longfield had the parliamentary secretary for Democratic Reform here. He did the town hall. It's not a thing that the Liberals are looking at. Having said that, there's got to be, I think, unilateral apolitical support for whatever happens. And it just seems like that probably isn't going to be. And perhaps that's what's, you know, in the milk that they're warning about, that if the conservatives are sitting there in those comms meetings going, no, we want a committee, say, we want a referendum, say, we're going to go to the polls, say, lots of time before 2019, see, I don't know where that comes from, but still, it's
I think I do,
but it's
you can hear us off the air, folks, tell you something else,
but that seems to be where the real troubles come from. So, yeah, like we can, you know, make fun of Trudeau for saying silly things to Montreal newspapers all day long, but that's where the rubber's really going to hit the road, throwing metaphors all over the place, that what are they going to come back with if there can be a consensus reach? Because I have a feeling this has to be a decision where there is consensus, and I mean across all parties and not just
yeah, and this
the,
is
the left-leaning parties.
The challenge of consensus is that it isn't just, well, most of them agree, right? It could be everybody agrees. Elizabeth May, who I believe is on the committee, doesn't agree, and then that's, you don't have consensus. You have like 98%. So talk about electoral reform.
I don't think Elizabeth May's the disagreeable one.
But in terms of reforming the committee, it's like, okay, if you're going to work in consensus, why don't we have consensus government? Then they do in Nunavut, right?
Yeah.
And they don't have parties. So we do have a territory in Canada that doesn't even have, well, at least in name, political parties, right? So there's plenty of room for... Now, mind you, Nunavut came about in 99, so maybe, let's see what the committee has to say.
All righty.
And then when we do get Trudeau on, if he'll have us, or if we'll have him, he can talk about it then.
We'll see what... Yeah, we'll wait for the committee.
Sorry, Justin.
Did you just say we'd have Trudeau on?
Yeah, I'm still working on that.
All right.
He's a Facebook friend, people. Let us know. We want to get in touch with him. I doubt it, but maybe I'll just tweet him.
We're not ambitious
Yo,
here.
Yo, Justin.
Anyway.
We get Justin Bieber, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, snap. That'd
there
be sick.
Yeah, see what he has to say.
I mean, he is hating the light of, the people screaming at him at his concerts now.
Maybe something like a Bieber talk in politics, and that would be funny. He'd be like, hey, I don't know. Maybe he does. Maybe he's deeply into it.
It's worth noting that Katy Perry and Miley Cyrus were door knocking for Hillary Clinton on a college campus this week. So, anyway,
sweet.
It wasn't at the University of Guelph, but we're going to move to Muskrat Falls anyway. A company called Nalcor Energy, which is a crown corporation in Newfoundland, they are building this multi-billion-dollar hydroelectric dam on Lower Churchill River. And it is a project that has been heavily protested, and it's kind of it has made the news lately because it's gotten kind of heated. The Inuit community, which lives about 2,000 kilometers downriver in Lake Melville, is very, very concerned about something called methyl mercury. Anything with mercury in it is bad. And, if you're living downriver from a hydroelectric plant and, you get most of your food and resources from the water and the fish and the seals who are all part of that ecosystem, probably not going to want it poisoned with mercury. And so we have this protest. It did seem to come to an end last night. They had a kind of a marathon meeting between all levels, provincial, federal, local, and First Nations. All seem to agree that there's going to be more monitoring of the situation. My question on this, all this is, why didn't they have a meeting to begin with?
Yeah, this is the problem. I mean, I've got a feeling or the impression that there were meetings, but it just didn't hit the bar in terms of it's Nunatsiavut is considered an autonomous area. So again, this is across governments. They're essentially a separate government, right? So we have a crown corporation, and then we have the federal government responsible for the hydro. And it's federal provincial crossover, if I got it right. And there was dialogue there, and obviously it fell apart at some point. But there were hunger strikers as well. And interestingly, they broke their fast with a nice smoked char. It was a beautiful looking fish, hopefully low in mercury. But this, and it was interesting to me reading up on this in that they're not against the dam itself. Now, a lot of times you hear, say, with the example of Standing Rock, which looks like it's absolutely a mess this afternoon. I guess we'll probably talk about it next week. But Standing Rock looks like there's a crackdown going on.
Yeah.
This was a little bit different in that the main point of the protest was that methylmercury, which is can be a pretty nasty biotoxin, what happens is if they don't clear away all the vegetation and they fill the dam, it's just by its nature, methylmercury gets into the water and, of course, bioaccumulates and goes downstream. Right. Boy, I sounded like I knew what I was talking about there, right? But yeah, it's...
No, it's actually fairly...
Mercury in fish, not a good thing.
Yeah, you don't have to be scientifically savvy to get this. It just, there's naturally occurring mercury. When you flood a place that has vegetation, it releases the methylene. And then mixes with the mercury, and it becomes this very toxic thing. Now, they could easily mitigate this by just clearing the land of vegetation and soil and the topsoil, and that the odds of contamination
it's gonna be underwater anyway, right?
Right. The odds of contamination go down from 380% to 13.
Yep.
That's how, just by clearing the land, I don't know how much that would have, extra that would have cost, but we're already talking about a project that when it was approved and started, it was a $7.4 billion project. Now it's an $11.4 billion project because of delays and cost overruns and all that. But, you know, considering all that, I wonder how much it would have cost us to clear the land to begin with and just have done this right.
Yeah, and there's a way to clear the land. I mean, they could do it and, you know, take all the lumber. And but generally, the projects like this, the way they do it is just clear it. Like, yeah. Just get rid of it. Whereas, you know, there's a, let's call it a sustainable way to do it. But, of course, that takes time. I'm not sure why the indigenous community couldn't be involved with that either.
Yeah.
Maybe they will be. I don't know. Like, it's not that ridiculous an idea. I don't think so. But so it sounds like the solution was that they're going to have an independent advisory committee that's going to continuously monitor the project. And I guess it was weird. Not weird, but it's, though I was reading there was a study that came out of Harvard University, I think specific to this,
yeah,
regarding the methylmercury, saying, you know, if you don't do this, there's going to be a problem. And of course, we've seen problems
hardly
in the past.
A granola of, you know, yeah, left-leaning,
exactly,
hippie-hugging place, Harvard, yeah.
Yeah, but examples in the past, one that we've talked about is Grassy Narrows, where a paper mill was shooting mercury in the community, mm-hmm, and they're still feeling the effects of that, and it's like 20, 30 years later. Deep, lasting effects.
Yeah.
So, like I said, it's not really a Standing Rock situation there, that there's been dialogue between the premier and the indigenous leaders, and it looks like they've come up with a solution. But we'll see. It gets to the point where it's like, okay, we'll see. Okay, they're going to have a committee. That's great. Hopefully, they're going to do hard science and keep an eye on things. But like you say, if they don't clear the vegetation away, then the percentage will obviously be much higher. So yeah, that seems to be the duh kind of solution. Like why don't you just do this?
Yeah.
So hopefully they will. But it's like I said, it was interesting to me that they weren't arguing against the dam completely. So
right.
There's obviously some. I don't even know if it's incentive or whatever. Not an incentive from the government necessarily, but, you know, they're probably happy to see it because...
It's a question of procedure, mm-hmm, right? It's, you know... And I think we were talking about this to an extent when we were talking about pipelines last week. That, you know, it's a small community of people, so we'll just do whatever the heck we want. We'll do it the cheap, easy, efficient way. And, you know, if something happens, we're only affecting a small number of people. And this is kind of where it goes... all wrong. It's like as soon as people kind of get wind of something, it doesn't become any small thing. And this seems to be what happens again and again. They reach these deals that are going to affect these communities. The communities start hitting back. The protests get louder, louder, louder. And then eventually the media starts paying attention, sometimes a lot later than we would like. And then it becomes a big thing. And then... You see, the solution was just so easy in the first place. It's like having a meeting and getting everybody on the same page and agreement. And you're like, well, why did it get this far to begin with? And to talk about to connect this back to our friends in Ottawa, the first topic, Nick Whalen, who's MP for the area, said, "Well, why don't they eat less fish then if they're concerned about mercury? Waka waka waka." That wasn't a direct quote, but it was more or less not what he wrote on Twitter. And then he had to take it back the next day.
Fozzie like, Bear, MP, said, yeah.
It just,
what a dumb know, thing to tweet.
It's such a dumb like
Trump,
thing to
Trump-like
tweet.
Tweet, right?
It was totally Trump-like. Yeah. I thought, it took me a minute to clue in that Nick Whalen, as a MPP for Newfoundland, or an MP for Newfoundland is a liberal.
Mm-hmm.
That whole area is liberal. And he's, you know, I would have expected this from, like, some sort of conservative backbencher who's like, well, I'm just getting in the way of creating jobs and creating industry, waka waka. I don't know. But it comes from, you know, from the party who has purposely gone out and said, we are going to be different from what's gone before. And that seems so 2014 to say, like, why do you eat less fish? Huh? We weren't supposed to be looking at these things that way anymore. We're supposed to listen to the serious concerns of our First Nations people and treat them seriously and treat them, key word here, as partners, which, again, in this situation, did not happen.
I'm voting Donaldson next time. I like that a lot. Yeah, we'll have to ask. This is a bit of an aside, too. I'll ask Candace about Twitter. Is there a way to delay tweets? Like, is there a software that exists where you can just sort of write a tweet and then rather than send it right away, I guess you could pause.
You can schedule them. Apps that schedule them.
You could take a step back and say, I don't know if I should send this. I don't know if I should shoot my mouth off or get up at 3 a.m. and tweet madly like Trump seems to do. But yeah, that was a really dumb move. And of course, it happened to be a liberal guy. It's like, guys, come on. Where is this Sunny Ways thing? This is more of the same.
I'm kind of sick of the Sunny Ways.
Yeah.
Stuff,
Sunny Ways. Not Lighthouse. They're in town.
Because Trudeau was booed this week at some sort of youth conference. I can't remember the details, but he
Back's
was like
turn,
booed
yes.
and cheered and backs turned.
Well, a lot
like,
of that.
Oh, it's a dark clouds on the Sunny Ways.
A lot of that was to do with Morneau. I guess this is a super aside, but Morneau saying that, you know, precarious work is the way of the future. Get used to it. In essence, that's what he said. I'm paraphrasing, but it's like, get used to it. So, like, this seems to be more of going back to topic one, too, about. Well, we're going to change everything. It's going to be great, Sunny Ways. And then it's like, well, you know what? It's actually going to be more of the same for your generation. So, I mean, if I was a young worker, I'd probably be pissed off, too. So they're just expressed it.
Well, I mean,
if I was an Inuit or an Indigenous person in Newfoundland, Labrador, and they weren't listening to me, and I had autonomous territory, and I eat fish every day, including to break my hunger strike, I'd be pretty PO'd as well.
Well, exactly.
But I'm generally PO'd anyway, so that's why I sit in this chair and talk about the issues.
You're listening to CFIU.
Something that's like one of my favorite songs. It's been named one of the ultimate cheating songs. The guys that wrote it were like, hey, they were cheating at cards, and I thought, well, let's write a song about that. Dark End of the Street off the new, brand new, just into the station yesterday, Hidden Cameras album. Hidden Cameras are playing the Starlight tonight. Google the Starlight if you're wanting to go see them. And that was Dark End of the Street. So yeah, what more can I say?
That's an excellent
I guess your
question.
Cheating heart might be the ultimate cheating song, but The Dark End of the Street is definitely.
Well, that's not about cheating.
Such a good.
Cards.
I don't know what about. There's something about that song. I don't know. So.
Anyway,
I will play it again.
We're not talking about cheating.
You're cheating, huh?
Well, actually, we're not talking about cheating because we have the CETA trade agreement to talk about.
We're talking about Ezra Levant. Huh.
Well, he's
speaking of cheating. Huh?
I'm not, sorry. Not sure.
Sorry. No.
Not sure what happened there. Okay, so there there's this area of Belgium known as Walluna, I think.
Wallonia.
It is. Wallonia. Sorry, I can't even read my own handwriting. Wallonia, there it is.
Where the Walloons live.
Exactly.
Out of a Dr. Seuss book.
3.5 million people live there, and apparently they have veto power. They're one of the few regions, or one of a couple of regions in Belgium that have veto power over what the national government says and does, and they exercised that veto power last weekend when they were saying, no, we do not like some of these provisions in this CETA trade agreement. And to Christina Freeland, International Trade Minister's great disappointment, it looked like CETA was done. But some very tight negotiations last week, and they announced today that CETA is indeed got Wallonia back on board and that it will be signed at a later date. They just have to get all the parliaments in the EU to cross the T's and dot the I's. What I didn't notice in all the discussion about Wallonia and CETA and what's what, I have no idea what's in this trade agreement.
Well, this is one of the things that Wallonia have a problem with, I think, in that, and those that are coming out against it, we've seen Council of Canadians, among others, saying, like, you know, they ram these agreements through. And in some ways, say what you want about Donald Trump. There are times, as with everyone, that he's right. And when he's, and I don't know if
broken NAFTA, clocks right twice a day.
Yes, exactly. And I don't know if NAFTA is the worst trade agreement ever. But stuff like this, when it comes up and there's...
I believe it's a disaster.
A disaster. It's a disaster of epic proportions. Yeah, we weren't going to talk about Trump this week, but somehow he bled into it.
That's how he likes it.
And this, the whole veto power of this reminded me, and the commentary that went with it, reminded me of Elijah Harper. When they needed unanimous consent on the Meech Lake Accord, he held up a feather and held that up. Meech Lake Accord pretty much dies. Clyde Wells in Newfoundland jumps on board. We're going back to 1990, folks. You want some electoral history? I'll give you some. political history. But this is the kind of thing they're saying, oh, the Walloons shouldn't be able to hold this up. I thought Chrystia Freeland is supremely qualified to do this. She's probably more qualified than Jerry Ritz, who is a goof, in my opinion, right? The guy, in terms of, you want to put two people head to head and say, who do you want talking to Europe about this agreement? You want Chrystia Freeland, not Jerry Ritz. And that whole commentary about, you know, grow up and get over there and was just ridiculous. Now, I know she was emotional, but when you're flying back and forth and the pressure is on, you're going to get emotional. That whole aside really irked me because, I mean, this agreement was, it's, when did they start? 2009? So it's pretty much, I would see it as a, you know, the criteria that are in it were conservative structure, right? The liberals have to work with it. And I don't know if that's where Jerry Ritz's sort of flippant comment is coming from. That's twice who said flippant. That is the word of the week. But it is. It's very like, you know, you should grow up and get over there. And it's like, no, they took a step back and said this, you know, it's up to the Belgians, the Walloons at this point, who are, I mean, they're a unique area. They're, well, I love that they're blaming on the fact that they're socialist, but it's not that simple, right? They had a lot of issues with some of the stuff that was in there. And it sounds like they've come up with a mechanism to not solve it, but to address the issues that they have. It's like, it almost sounds to me, going back to Canadian constitutional, like the notwithstanding clause, where they can take a step back and say, you know what, we don't really want to be a part of that. Now, as to whether that counts as special treatment and whether it's going to go beyond and other districts are going to say, no, we don't want that either, that remains to be seen yet. But it sounds like the Walloons are, at least the Wallonian government is happy now. And that's just before we airtime. It sounds like an agreement
this morning,
has been reached.
This is what Gary Ritz said, by the way. I had it. Since the trade minister... Should I do the 20s voice? Since the trade minister is incapable of or unwilling to do her job and ratify this vital trade deal with the prime minister, grab some adult supervision, get on a plane, and go back over to Brussels to get this job done. Waka, waka, waka.
The waka, waka, waka is a quote. 100% accurate impersonation of Jerry Ritz.
But, I mean, yeah. I mean, that's sort of one level to it. It's sort of like... And he kind of kept up the attacks on her. Which... I understand, I mean, that I think it was Ritz that said, in a non-partisan attacking way, it's like, well, this is something the conservative government negotiated for 7 years. Now it's flushed down the drain. I'm doing two different impressions for Gary Richter.
I was to give the impression that it's the liberals that are blowing it, and that's not – I mean, there's obviously room for improvement, but it's not them. You know, it sounds like that they did their job, I guess, as they're supposed to, but
– yeah, that's exactly right. It was all on the
partisan
UN.
Partisan points.
And right? – I mean, let's face the facts. The EU is kind of...
it's a unique relationship.
It's a unique relationship, yeah. And it's having some fairly difficult times right now.
Yeah.
It's also not a uniform body, although as much as it's a uniform body, it's not a uniform body. So you have to look at it that way. So the partisanship and the sexism,
yes.
There's really
pure
no other way to look at it.
Yep.
It's sexism. Is one thing that I'd like to leave aside, but I guess we have to address it. But leaving just that aside, looking at the darn thing as an agreement, I thought at the beginning of the week it would have been a really effective way, or it would have been, I think it would have been the best of both worlds for the liberals if the Wallonians killed it. That
there you go.
Yeah, because you know they don't have to worry about passing it. There is a lot of people because there is a loud constituency who are not for this. There is a loud constituency where yes, all free trade is good. The truth is probably somewhere in between, but it's hard. I mean, these agreements are hard to get your mind around when you have all the information. I don't think we have all the information about this. I don't think we have any information about
it. Well, I can give you an example of something that's leaked out and is obviously going to be in there, is that along the lines, and going back to NAFTA as well, you may recall way back there was a situation in Canada where there was an additive put into gasoline and the Liberal government passed a regulation against it saying we don't want, I think it was MMT, don't want that in the gasoline. And Ethyl Corporation, whoever it was behind that, sued and got a lot of money. They won under the guise of NAFTA and these court bodies that exist sort of beyond our judicial system are able to make a decision and Canada has to pay. And it sounds like that's something the Wallonians were upset with in that, you know, it caters to corporate power as opposed to, let's just say, people power. So an example would be genetically modified foods. A lot of European states and countries have legislation, again, they don't want GMOs.
Right.
So that was something that had to, according to what I saw before airtime, was something that was in there saying that, you know, you can't touch this. And it was a lot. Can't touch this. But true, though. And along the lines of when we saw discussions before, it was the 10 years ago when they were trying to discuss a similar trade agreement. It was the dairy farmers in Quebec who have a supply management system. Didn't want that touched. And they got the blame for killing it outright because they have something that they didn't want to give up. And that's why these deliberations take 7, 8, 9, 10 years, is because there is a certain amount of accommodation involved. So as to whether this is going to shake loose or is it going to be that a company with GMOs is going to say, no, we want, you know, you have to have this. You cannot grow your own canola. You have to take our, you know, that kind of thing. So they've been given promises, but will they be kept, or is it going to be these, you know, these mysterious courts that exist?
Right. That's where these trade agreements,
fail, in my view.
I mean, I don't think anyone doubts the hypothesis that more free trade equals more opportunity and more chance for advancement for people and opening up new markets. That is pretty sound economic theory. Where we get in trouble is something like the TPP is where we start handing over controls to huge corporations. Mm-hmm. You know, those conditions in the TPP that say, you know, if you're caught violating copyright, you know, they can just rip something down off the internet and slap you with fines, and there's nothing you living here in Canada can do about it. If it's coming from somewhere like Thailand, let's say, or if you're living in Thailand, it's coming from someplace in the United States where there are huge oligarchical media companies, which is probably the primary concern. that's the dicey situation. I think that's where Wallonia's concerns are primarily, is just how much power are corporations taking, especially when it seems like corporations are consulted more than people when it comes to these kind of trade agreements.
A lot of these trade agreements are designed for corporations, flat out, full stop. I don't think there's, you know, the theory, and it is a theory, and is that, well, it will float all boats. You know, if the corporations are doing well, they'll create employment, and, you know, ask anybody that's in manufacturing in Ontario, or was, but they don't have a job now because their company was run into the ground by a, never mind. I could go all day about equity firms and pleasing shareholders and, you know, it's happened in our town. It's happened in lots of towns. And again, this is something, to go back to Trump, something Trump has tapped into. They'll say the unemployment rate in the States is low, but tell that to somebody in the Rust Belt. Honestly, tell that to somebody in the Rust Belt. They've seen their company go. They have no job. They're going to the food bank, you know.
Well, I mean, the unemployment numbers don't tell you the whole story.
Never.
Because there's underemployment, there's precarious employment, there's temporary jobs.
They need to make precarious its own category, really.
Yeah.
Full-time, part-time, and God, no time, right? Or whatever.
Or, yeah, temporary, you know.
Yeah, they don't, though. It's...
There was a rabble piece I just want to take note of, because I think it's an important issue, and it deals with the issue of Romani people, Roma, who are sort of...
Gypsy, shall we say, well, they're gypsies, the old term,
to use
yeah.
the old term. Yep. I don't. Yeah, gypsies.
Romani, yeah.
this leads nicely into our next topic.
Mm. Sorry, gypsies.
The Roma people, who are not welcome. It's still in many corners of Eastern and Central Europe. Mm-hmm. Many of whom come to Canada to seek refugee status, and of course, there's been these. Court cases for years about, are Roma people refugees? Can you be refugees from a friendly country like Hungary or Romania? And
who aren't particularly friendly to the Roma.
To Italy, exactly.
As well, another one.
Yeah, exactly. And what status are these people going to have if they're trying to get away from territories that are discriminatory to them under these new kinds of international agreements?
Yep.
And it's sort of, I mean, it's one of these human rights issues that kind of gets lost amongst all the economic talk about, you know, what sectors are going to benefit, and et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, I felt it was a kind of an important point to bring up that
it's just
Europe isn't like the socialist bastion, universal, progressive, lovely place. And I think we're kind of seeing that more and more, especially as we're watching like scenes of France taking apart this refugee camp that's called the jungle.
Yeah, France, which has a socialist government. So
yeah.
Yeah.
So
50 Shades of Red.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's important to keep in mind, too. One person who definitely doesn't like the socialist bent in Europe is our old friend Ezra Levant. He has a media site called The Rebel. He wanted to send three members of The Rebel to the COP22 conference. That is the yearly conference on climate change hosted by the United Nations. He applied to the United Nations for media accreditation. They said, no, we do not accept advocacy journalists, which... is kind of a lie, because there are a lot of people who write advocacy journalism on behalf of, you know, climate change and supporting action against climate change and pro-environment. What Ezra Levant says he thinks they meant, and he wrote a piece on the Financial Post about it, they meant opinion journalism, primarily people who are anti-action on the environment, like he is. So I think this is one of the reasons we want to talk about this, of course, is journalistic freedom. This is a completely weird situation where he managed to get Penn Canada, the Canadian Journalists Free Expression, the Canadian Association of Journalists, on his side, advocating for him. And on top of that, he went to the Trudeau government and said, hey, can you help me out in this situation? And Catherine McKenna, the Minister of the Environment and Climate Change, said yes, even though Ezra Levant himself admitted she has blocked him from her Twitter feed because she is kind of a needle in her side.
Yeah, it's one of those cases where, you know, do we help this guy out in the name of, well, let's say press freedom, which is a constitutional right? She had said that they would intervene for any outlet that was accredited with the Parliamentary Press Gallery. That was their exact quote. Now, it sounds like Brian Lilly, who is one of the correspondents, does have press credentials on Parliament Hill. So maybe this is sort of a bit of a workaround for the Liberals. They're saying, okay, we can work with this guy specifically. They didn't say that. It's like a little bit of a loophole, let's say. Like,
I think
we will approve this guy.
Yeah, I think Lilly is accredited. I don't think he's a member of the press gallery, though,
but
which
then
is a thin distinction.
Yeah, but from what I read this week, and I didn't read the article because it's the Beaverton, and I'm never sure whether it's true or not. The Beaverton, if you don't know it, folks, is the like the Canadian Onion, let's say, and it's pretty hilarious.
Yeah,
but it sounds
good.
Like they have press credentials now, and I don't know if they were joking around, but it was this is not a joke. You never know with Facebook and social media, but
well, they do have a TV show coming, the Beaverton, so
yeah. So if the Beaverton can get it, you would think that the Rebel, like them or not, but then of course the Rebel come out and say, well, we're going to go to Morocco anyway and shout questions at the delegates. So, yeah, like that's going to win you some friends. It's like it'll be stuff like, well, since climate change isn't real, why are you even here? Like that is the kind of thing I hear when I hear the Rebel, and I couldn't bring myself to look at their website. Even it was just so, you know, I don't want my browser history to have that on it.
You don't want,
I do erase it regularly, but it's like, you know what? I can't do it just because I dislike them that much. Having said that, I would love to have Ezra Levant on this show. I would. I absolutely would, because, and this is what the UN person that was handling the credentials said. It sounded like to him that the Rebel was a one-person band. How's that for equal language? One-person band rather than a serious media operation. So I guess they did what anybody would do. It's like, okay, who is this Rebel? And they look at it, and you just see Ezra Levant going, wah, wah, wah. Ethical oil. Fracking is good. You know, that does sound like a one-person band rather than do they have people doing actual journalism. And we've talked about this before. Who is a journalist? To me, and I've said this before too, to me, Adam is a journalist. I'm not. I'm a guy running the controls, and we talk politics once a week. That's my, what's not my right. job, but that's what I do. So the question is, where do you draw the line? And it sounds like the goalposts are moving a little bit as to where this line is going to be.
Well, that's the sketchy ethical area. It's like once you start saying who is not a journalist, you sort of impugn yourself the power to say who is a journalist. That's what happened earlier this year at the Alberta legislature.
Yes.
When Rachel Notley said to the Rebel, oh, you guys aren't journalists, so we're going to be, choosing
who
stays.
Well, sorry, it was one of their
people
that said that. It wasn't her directly, right?
Yes.
And then she had to come out. They did a bit of a backtrack. But
I mean, you can't tell me she wasn't like, yes, get those people out of here.
Well, yeah.
Because, like, Rachel Notley's basically Ezra Levant's arch nemesis right now. But yeah, and that situation blew up in the Alberta government's face too. I mean, because I think for a lot of people, Ezra Levant doesn't represent anything in particular except what Ezra Levant hates. And there isn't a point that the UN is making that, yeah, he is the kind of the one face of it, the one man band behind it. But would you say that about Huffington Post? And Arianna Huffington?
Or
would you say that about Canada Land and Jesse Brown?
Well, let's take the example of Athalia Raj, right?
Sure.
Who works for Huffington Post and is on CBC all the time. I'm sure she would get credentials, no problem, because to me, she's actually a journalist. Whereas Ezra Levant, he can be the head of this organization and have journalists beneath him. And it sounds like Brian Lilly, et cetera. That's how it works. Like he's more of like a Thompson, let's say, or
sure.
the head of the news organization, or Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah.
You don't want Rupert Murdoch covering the event.
I don't think Ezra Levant was going to go though.
But he does go though, and he does that confrontational. It's sort of like a Canadian Alex Jones, a little bit more reserved. But he does, he'll do the red face yelling at people. And why did
he
you?
He wasn't
do this?
One of the three though.
No, but if his behavior, and I think the other people that work for the Rebel echo this behavior too. It's the way in which it's confrontational. It's not drive-by journalism. They call it like ambush, right?
Well,
so rather than,
yes.
there's a way to do that, and they don't do it well, in my view. I don't think there's a way to, regardless of what your opinion is on something, if you're, let's just say, pro-climate change, they're going to go to a climate change conference, and everybody at this conference and most of the media and the scientists have accepted this exists. You're the contrarian. You're going to go there, and it's the way that they ask the questions, I think, is the key problem, because they'll say, well, this study says that it's actually not true. So what do you think? Like, it's ridiculous stuff. So is that journalism? Or you're just going and throwing a wrench into it for the hell of it? to promote this opinion, which is, you know, somebody called it the gadfly style, you know?
I hate everything they represent.
Yeah,
but
me too. Do they have the right to go?
I would still give them the passes. I think they have the right to go. I would still give them the passes.
And I would say yes. And if they act up, then
they
give
have,
them the boots.
I mean,
but
they have
their they kicked us out.
Yeah, they have their audience.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Sorry.
They have their audience. They obviously appeal to the audience. And clearly, you know, they are able to raise enough money to send three people to Marrakesh. I barely have enough money to, you know, to go and have to get a McNugget meal at McDonald's.
I should laugh at that. But
no, it's fine. But like to give you an example,
to rub together.
To give you an example, how much money they have to burn. Earlier this month, he had a truck with a sign in the back, driving around Ottawa, you know, saying Justin Trudeau's best friend gets $127,000 from taxpayers for moving. And this is about the whole, you know, moving expenses issue from a couple of months ago.
Then they wonder why they don't get invited to the party.
I understand.
Drunk uncle's loose and he's got a sign. Right?
I understand. Interesting side note, though. The cameraman that the rebel is wanted to send to COP 22, his name is Alex Jones. So maybe they just
maybe
saw the paperwork
and
they're like, wait a minute, they're bringing Alex Jones here? No, thank
He'd
you.
He'd be like, Catherine McKenna is a demon. Something like that. Smells like sulfur. I can smell her from here.
Yeah, it's so,
did not actually happen.
But the other person, one of the other people they're going to send was Sheila Gunn-Reid, who is not exactly a friend to the environmental lobby.
And having said all that, like we've said, that's fine. But they need to, I don't know, do they need to dial it back a bit or something? Maybe they don't, but it's just, it's decorum, right? You know, you wouldn't do that. You're a journalist. You wouldn't dream of doing that, would you?
No, but
it's their style. It's their shtick. It's like, it's how it gets eyes on the prize. And then
it's not my style.
Eyes on the Rebel page, right?
But do they
advertise? Do they have any advertising in the Rebel page?
They probably do. But, I mean, the thing is,
that's what it's about.
If it's...
And pleasing their corporate overlords.
It's not up to the UN to decide who is a journalist and who is not. It is up to...
it's up to them to decide who gets to come to their thing.
I understand, but this is what they're talking about is as soon as you start barring the rebels of the world, you start barring the Guelph Politicos of the world. And it's I hate the slippery slope principle, but
I want
once
you
start being... Well, I'm sure as heck not going to Morocco.
No, but you could apply, and if they say yes, then we'll prove the point that...
Very true.
Yeah. Next up on...
Yeah, it's... I mean, it's a tricky world out there. There's more press than ever. But I think as soon as... It's not up to the government bodies themselves to label who is a journalist or not. If we disagree with the rebel, it is up to them to... perhaps to explain to the other media that's there why the rebel point of view is wrong and why the other point of view is right. But it's not up to the UN to decide that the rebel is not a journalistic endeavor. That is up to the people who read the rebel or the people who don't read the rebel to decide whether or not.
I wish I played rebel now. Maybe next time we talk about this.
Yes,
when we get Ezra Levant on the show.
I'm sure he'll come up again because he's just that kind of guy.
Oh, yeah.
And
he's on our hot list.
We do know that coming up on the show on November 10th, we will have Ward 6 Councillor Carl Wettstein. I'm also waiting for Mayor Cam Guthrie's office to get back to me. We hope to have him on. It will likely be after budget time, so probably sometime in the next couple of months he'll be on the show as well. And if you have questions for these or any other people, you want to reach out to us, you go to opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, and at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. And, of course, download the podcast through the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean and iTunes. I am on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Twitter, Scotty Hertz on Facebook. I blog at a place called The Spanner Book. And that's all I wrote.
And you can come back here next week for more Open Sources. We will be back here next Thursday at 5 p.m. And stay tuned now for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour. You are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.